Welcome to episode 5 of Speaking of Liberty. I'm your host, Sarah Brady Wagner. We are happy to bring you another episode of Speaking of Liberty after a little bit of a hiatus, and we are able to do so because of the exciting addition of our new sound designer, Adam Brooks. Adam is a former candidate with the Libertarian Party of North Carolina and has been an absolute asset to the executive committee now, as well as just an overall wonderful volunteer. And thanks to him, we will be bringing you episodes of Speaking of Liberty on a regular basis once again. So in this week's episode, I've taken a chance to sit down with Olin Watson, who is a former candidate for Raleigh City Council and a community organizer in Raleigh. So we talk about some of the issues that the communities in urban areas are facing, specifically in Raleigh, but also these same issues are mirrored throughout the country, of the relations between the community and the police force that is charged with protecting them, and the frictions that come up in that when you add in all sorts of factors of issues with inherent bias, as well as issues with training or a lack of training around issues of mental health. So Olin does get into some issues of a little bit more of a personal nature in towards the end of the interview, where he discusses his own experiences with the police while dealing with mental health issues. So I hope that you guys enjoy this episode, and it's, you know, gives us some really great insight into the issues that we're facing in our neighborhoods. Today we are here with Olin Watson, a Raleigh area community organizer and activist, and he's here to talk with us about community policing and specifically how the law enforcement officers relate to the communities in the Raleigh area and how people perceive their law enforcement officials.
Hey, Sarah, it's good to see you today.
Thanks for coming out to talk with us.
Yeah.
So what is going on in Raleigh as far as how do people perceive their police officers? Is it pretty uniform between communities, or would you say there's different ways that people perceive their police officers?
Well, much like the rest of America, 100 years ago, police forces decided to professionalize. There were a lot of abuses in the past, and those efforts to professionalize the career have led to a great sort of homogenization of policing practices. The federal government is very active in trying to take lessons learned from bad scenarios, bad situations, and applying them to try to learn and improve. So Raleigh, much like a lot of cities, has sort of carbon copied that and sort of cut and pasted it right here in our great capital city.
So the issues of community relations has really gotten a lot of attention lately because there have been so many national stories about, you know, unarmed citizens being shot by police. And even recently, with the case of Amy Hughes, who the Supreme Court a few days ago had determined that she's not allowed to seek out any sort of case against an officer who shot her in her own house, or not in her house, I'm sorry, in her own yard, 8 times. When
that horrible. Stephen Clark in Sacramento recently, the pure passion and desperation in his brother's voice is just, it instilled in me the fear, the outright fear that African Americans have of police in America. It's not just a political point. It's not just a political goal. It's fear. And I did say earlier that we're sort of a carbon copy. And what worries me is that in doing that sort of carbon copy, we will have the same successes, but we will also have the same failures. And that's what I fear. We had it in Charlotte a couple years ago, had some riots there. In the last months, we've had a 60-year-old man, a passenger, shot because a policeman saw the handgun of his pistol. We saw, I think, 5 or 6 deaths in North Carolina already this year. One man just trying to give up a gun to the police, he ended up getting shot. And there it seems like it might have been a language barrier thing. But one of the problems is the culture, the construction of what it means to be a policeman, its essential nature is one of violence. There is on that belt, there's a gun, extra clips, a taser, pepper spray, a baton, handcuffs. That is not communicating peacefulness. It's not communicating resolution. And those implements of each crept in as a way to solve different situations. But every one of them is the context of violence, fear, and certainly it's not what we want for the Raleigh area. It's not what I want for my country and my countrymen.
You know, I think that's a very legitimate concern, but a lot of people would say to that that it's violence that's necessary to counteract the violence that is, you know, present with crime, the violence that's already in our neighborhoods, that we need these police to respond in kind in order to protect those people who are not violent.
Yeah, 550-ish before the Common Era, it was the Tao Te Ching, this great guy named Lao Tzu. He says, you make a law and you make criminals. People that had been doing things all along to no harm, and you make a law and all of a sudden they're criminals. And they are instantly in fear for their lives. We have not introduced fear and violence necessarily because it was already there, but because of incarceration, loss of money, loss of family, loss of opportunity. So I think fundamentally, when we make laws, especially the ones that don't have victims, and we have a whole class called public order crimes, when we make those and we expand those, we're just dramatically increasing fear. We're dramatically increasing the opportunity for violence and the response necessary. As you point out, there's violence going both directions, and not all of it is evil. Some of it's just plain incompetence, you know. Some of it's just because of the situation I think that police are put on. Let me be clear about something really quickly here. I have a great burden here for the policemen. The policemen are put in a bad situation. They're given this bat belt, you know, sort of a Batman tool belt of violence. I don't know if they have a grappling hook yet, but maybe. It's true, though, that they're put in the situation where they know that they're going to have to be in a violent situation at one point, and they fear it as much as the people that are being watched, us regular citizens. So, I mean, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. This so one of the just perception issues that police seem to have been dealing with is, you know, they do have a really truly hard job to do.
Absolutely.
And you know, they're not necessarily paid as well as, say, some of our politicians are.
Right.
I work as a nanny, and I can say most policemen, especially at starting level, they don't make any more money than I do. It's that same, you know, working class level, and they have so much responsibility that's heaped onto them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the guy in Sacramento, one of the policemen, has been a police officer for 2 years. So, inexperience. How do you expect to be thrust in that arena with that little experience and be able to respond well? And then authorities, it's recorded on the body camera footage, on the audio tracks, somebody telling him to turn off the audio to his body camera. I mean, the temerity, the audacity, the fear that police departments have of retribution. The police fear retribution because of the context. And that just scares me to death. It scares me to death.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring up the body cameras. So that's just one way, you know, recently we had different types of technology that have improved accountability. But, you know, to the issue that you just talked about, that
there seems to almost be a fear of this. And there is such a huge difference in the level of accountability that is expected between citizens and police officers. I mean, the doctrine of qualified immunity at its most basic level says that, you know, for a citizen, for you or I, if we are to break a law, ignorance of the law is not an excuse.
Yes, that's correct.
But that same rule is not applied to
officers.
When you
have 5,000 pages of laws, I'm sure I broke a few today.
I'm sure I did too, but we would be subject to those laws.
Absolutely.
Whereas qualified immunity allows that a police officer, if they even violate your rights unknowingly, or they just they didn't know that that was a right that you're guaranteed, a good example being recording police officers.
Right.
There are plenty of times where a person will be ordered to stop recording. And there's nothing that can be done to hold that officer accountable, but even though in doing so, they're violating your rights.
Yeah, I feared for my life. That's in... You mentioned me as a community organizer. That's a title Mr. Obama had, and I wouldn't want to steal that from him. I do work with a lot of folks in our community on different issues. But that's the refrain I hear all the time. The idea that the policeman, all he has to do or all she has to do is say, I was fearing for my life. And all of a sudden, the whole context of the conversation changes. Because that, it's like I said, both parties, and I wrote an article that was in, I believe it was North State Journal last year, that we can illustrate pretty easily that both parties in any situation, the officer and the suspect, are both have a lot of fear going into this. And we just have to find a way to neuter the fear. And it is not by training police officers further. A lot of times we as libertarians try to just sort of say, get rid of government, but we can do that maybe eventually someday. Sure. But let's try. We got to recognize that tomorrow we have to have a solution. And the solution is not, in this case, is not necessarily training. Let me illustrate that this way. There's a percentage of police, a very high percentage, is very competent, very good, very kind people, and work their best to try to apply the law as gently as possible. There's a percentage of the policemen that, regardless of training, will always be incompetent. It's true in every job. When I was in the Marine Corps, we said 10% of you are going to screw this up every time. It's just incompetency. Now, and also, we also know social science teaches us that in every profession of trust, pastoral care, psychotherapy help, medical help, doctors, nurses, teachers, that there are sociopaths, that will enter those professions pointedly in order to harm people. So it is true that no amount of training will ever end the problems that we're seeing. So the other answer we often hear is similarly useless. So libertarians, let's try to find a different path. And what I've realized is that, as I said about Lao Tzu earlier, let's remove those public order laws. It's an easy thing. They're not, nobody is harmed. Nobody needs restitution. And ultimately what happens is people lose jobs. They lose income to pay for their food for their family. So they depend on social services more. And what we find is the return on the investment of that arrest is extremely poor. It's negative. So not only are they failing to pay taxes, now they're using tax dollars in the court system, or worse, in the prison system. So.
Well, so the one other angle that I've heard, not talked about nearly as much, but, you know, as a community organizer, as an activist who's out in talking to the people who are affected, what is done on that end? I mean, there's people who talk about, well, we just need to train our children in school how to interact with police better, or we need to, you know, make sure. It's the idea that, well, if you had just listened and done as you were told, then nothing bad would have happened.
Well, I don't know about you, but most adults I know don't like to listen to me. I don't know if that's because of my wisdom or lack thereof. I know my children refuse to listen to me. I think that's sort of farcical. There is always the condition. And let us be honest that we will never find a situation where people don't die. People die. And we will always have situations that are contentious, that it's horrible. But my goal is to help people understand, let's just reduce that number. Let's reel things back. Find, I would love, I mean, I use the number 100. Everybody does this. I take 100 policemen in Raleigh and let's take them out of enforcement and put them in bus service to get kids to the parks. So those police that are trained how to handle gang members, how to handle kids that are in tough situations, adults in tough situations, they're really in the community and maybe really can be of real help. I mean, police officers often act as therapists, I'm going to tell you. They are out there fixing bike wheels. And don't we love seeing those pictures on Facebook? You know, they're all there, but amongst the pictures of cats and I don't know, all the other things on the internet, I love the ones of policemen changing bike tires, but there's not enough of those pictures. They're compelling, but they're not as compelling as seeing this nighttime vision picture of Stephen Clark getting shot in his grandmother's backyard after looking in his grandmother's car. And what is a person going to remember? What are the people in my neighborhood going to remember? They're not going to remember the pictures of kittens or bicycle wheel changes. They're going to remember Stephen Clark and all of the other men and women that have been killed. And they're going to increase their fear. It's going to make things worse. It's just going to keep getting worse and worse until we do something dramatically different.
Well, we certainly have, you know, as humans, the negative things are more readily highlighted in our memory. And as many times, you know, you need 10 pictures of a helpful cop helping an old lady across the street or changing a bike tire in order to make up for, you know, that one horrifying example of abuse of authority or of, you know, overuse of force where right. It might not have been necessary. So, you know, that just brings to me to mind that so much of what police departments, not necessarily individual police officers, but police departments as an entity deal with is public perception.
Right.
So in North Carolina, we have a law that specifically relates to the body cameras that the officers wear, that they're not released as public record. And the fear around that is that you're only getting part. You're not seeing the whole context, you know. And that can go both ways. The officer who's out helping someone change his tire, is he also then trying to stop and frisk that same kid because he looks suspicious?
Well, let's say that stop and frisk worked in New York City. I don't like it, especially as a libertarian. I do not like that they use stop and frisk. But it is true that sometimes harsh methods do produce results. So we can't just strictly look at results and say, that's the whole story, right? We have to look beyond that and say, is it something that in the end really, it may improve security, but it also may harm what it means to be an American, that freedom to be an American. We are free to make mistakes. And the greatest harm is to these young men looking in cars. Jaywalking, as somebody happened recently. Let's get back to that body cam. You brought up the body camera. This is sort of the source of your question. It was amazing to me in the community meetings. Raleigh has started to do a better job than it has in the past with communicating to the citizens and getting feedback. So they sent the officers around with demonstration pieces and talked to them about the proposed policies. And one of the policies parts was, well, because we have to ensure people's privacy, what we want to do is allow the officer to turn off the camera. And, that's great. We're going to protect privacy. However, like we said, for Stephen Clark, the leadership said that he needed to turn off the audio. And that, to me, I brought that up. I made suggestions to the technology. There's a button on that camera, and maybe it doesn't turn off. Maybe it cryptologically, I'm not that tech guy. Encrypt. Okay, thank you. You're the tech person, I guess, today. Yeah, it'll encrypt that, you know, so maybe it never is available until a judge's order, and you got to go through a huge rigmarole to get it. That camera should never go off. So even the effort to increase trust was another example of how it was diminishing trust. Them doing their best. So it goes back to my premise that the entire concept of policing is flawed. And if I may, I'd like to just identify the history of policing. Is that okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's obviously a very, we don't have time to go through the whole thing today. Just out of courtesy. In the North, watch Gangs in New York, one of my favorite shows. You had the Irish guy swinging his watch around and nobody liked him. It was one guy, and police chiefs were appointed by the union bosses and stuff like that. And there was a lot of corruption. That's the Northern. But in the South, it was a little different. And guess where we live? Where do we live, Sarah?
We live in North Carolina.
We live in the South. It may be North Carolina, but it's not the North.
No.
But in the South, it started with slave patrols. And let's say this. The first slave patrols started in the Carolinas. Now, the Carolinas, and I will include some of my reference materials in what we talk about.
In the show notes.
For your listeners. But those slave patrols just continued to morph systematized. Groups of people whose profession was to catch slaves all the time. And they were also charged with other police enforcement things. So we talked about, you remember, how it takes like 10 hugs to, you know, overcome one insult or something like this. I grew up thinking that slave history was a long time ago. But I tell you, Jim Crow was not. Jim Crow my peers' grandparents, my peers' parents grew up under Jim Crow. And there has been a continuous line from 1700 and before that until today where our African-American neighbors, our Black neighbors, have seen policemen as slave patrols. So there has never been those 10 hugs for that one insult. We have a great deal to do to reform, transform what it means to be a policeman. And I think we are set up right now for things to get worse and to eventually simply fail.
Well, outside of those issues are systemic issues that we have that are just backed up by, you know, disproportionate conviction rates and incarceration rates. But as to what we were saying before, where it comes to people worrying about, the officers are worried about the context that it's seen in, and people who are looking at it, you know, we always have a bias that we're going into these situations with. Do you think people maybe need to be a little bit more willing to entertain or to deal with some gray area when it comes to policing and community safety, and maybe even
as a libertarian? I'm like, no. Easy answer. Now, could you try to refine that question? I want to answer your question well.
Right. So before you had you had said that we all make mistakes.
Yeah.
But, you know, assuming that there's a good cop or good police officer,
right,
their intention going into a situation may not necessarily mesh with the outcome. And
yeah, we live in a mass culture. That's part of the problem. You know, let's say the one millionth of a chance that Stephen Clark was shot for 8 times and 20 bullets 8 times for some good reason. Yeah, maybe that time, but we live in a mass culture and you know, 99% of people will never understand the full context. So we're unfortunately left, even in those situations that are justified, nobody knows it and nobody can have that sense. So the greater contribution to our culture is never that it was justified. It always creates contention, and we have to find a way to get around this stumbling block. And it is not just obeying the police, because that just doesn't always work.
Well, I think one of the things there that creates that contention is we all want to be able to identify a victim and a villain.
Sure. Yeah, and that makes us feel good, even though usually it's a mix of both, right?
Exactly. So would you say that maybe in order to work through these issues, we have to find a way as a community to be comfortable with the fact that a lot of these situations may not lend themselves to an easy narrative?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a big Lao Tzu guy, that Tao Te Ching again. I mean, I go back to him. And for folks who don't know, Confucianism is sort of like just obey and government's really awesome. And Taoism is more like freedom of the people. But it says that the more you allow people freedom, the more they sort of monitor themselves. So I think the solution is allowing people to have that full sense of freedom and allowing people to take care of themselves, because yes, there are exceptions, but almost exclusively people want to have a peaceful life, and there are bad people out there. But when we are all free and we get that free air, and especially for African Americans who have never felt free, if they're given that chance, I believe in my heart of hearts that people are good.
One of the things that has come up many times, you know, in the national media, but is just as present in North Carolina, is that the police have become kind of a de facto. They're the line of government that seems to interface with the mentally ill community members. And they're not necessarily trained for that. And so we end up with situations where they're responding to somebody's need for help with violence as if they're a threat.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I say that with great reverence to God, for those who believe in him, that Dix Park in Raleigh, our city council decided to allow mental health facilities to be closed without guaranteeing the opening of new mental health facilities nearby. And that moves me to some thoughts that I hope it's okay to share about my personal life in a few moments with you. But let's just say those patients who are now subject to involuntary commitment are moved out of Raleigh, hours and hours away, all across the state, often have no access to family visits and provided no means to return to their home. So I think even though Dix Park is probably going to be a beautiful place, we've harmed a lot of the people who live in our city. We've harmed a lot of people who live in our state. And that question you're asking, let me just say that the police with a gun, you're subject to execution prior to having been judged guilty. That's just something I had to say there. That occurred to me a few weeks ago. You're subject to execution prior to even seeing a judge. And that just scares me. So I don't know if I am.
No, you did. There's, there are situations that police find themselves in where they may fear for their own lives, but they're not necessarily responding by considering everything rationally. And there are different ways that they treat different people based on their own personal biases.
You're right. Yeah, when in the Marines, we always think who's going to be the war hero. And the truth is the DOD, the government, for decades have tried to figure out the social profile, the DNA, the experience that determines what person is going to be a hero and which one is going to be a coward. And they have never been capable of figuring it out. And we will never be capable of figuring which police are going to act well under those circumstances through maybe no fault of their own. They act out of fear of their future. They act out of fear of their lives. Same with the people who are, you know, suspects. So
you highlighted a few times the difference in the way that the Black communities in Raleigh and the white communities in Raleigh perceive and are treated by police. And a lot of that comes down to individual biases.
Right.
And those kinds of things do play out just as you were talking about in those situations that you can't necessarily prepare for or screen for. So what experience or conversations have you had that have helped you to really understand that difference?
Sarah. obviously, you never know in any one situation how it might have gone different for some other person. During my recent run for Raleigh City Council, it came November time. It was a very stressful period. It was very personal, and I hope you'll give me a little grace here. I suffer from depression, and my therapist in November, or actually late October, decided to change my medication for me. That with family stress and the stress of running for city council, some stress sort of introduced by my ex-wife and her family, and my own stress in my own life with my, you know, blended family. Life gets tough. And we had sort of family conflict. And because of my medicine change, most likely, I wasn't myself for a moment. Police were called. And I was in my car, and I wasn't acting right, but they let me go because there was nothing legally they could hold me on. But the police followed me and put his lights on when I just decided to drive away. He didn't like that. He didn't have anything to hold me on, so he didn't have any reason to. It was my call that brought him there, strangely enough. So I put myself in my own situation. But he pulled me over, so I stopped with those lights, and I knew what I had to do. And being this wonderful libertarian that I am and paranoid about everything that we're always paranoid about, I rolled down the window, and I have a crank in my truck. It's an old truck, but, you know, too cheap to pay for the power ones. But I rolled down that window, and I thrust out my hands out the window and was begging the policeman to shoot me. Not because he was right, but because that's what policemen do. In my condition, I wasn't rational. I said, I had previously told him to call his boss. It took too long, that's why I left, initially. But I had my hands out, and I was begging him to be the worst version of himself that he could have been. It got worse from there later on that night. And he actually ended up having to let me go at that point. Like 6-8 police were there. They had to let me go. Because as crazy as I was being, I still knew my right. But I walked away after my involuntary commitment, after my involuntary commitment for about a week, right before the election. And I knew that if I was a Black man, it may not have led to death, but I just knew that it probably would have been very different. If I wasn't in a really nice neighborhood and around a very nice community of nice white folks with nice homes and nice cars, I just know it might have been different. And maybe if I was a Black man or a Hispanic man with a language barrier, maybe somebody not quite as well educated me as me knowing their rights and just being fearful, I probably would have been dead. And my children would have been fatherless. And I sort of reflect on that. I was very active all before this and the idea of police brutality. Because police brutality is real. So is mental illness. And our mentally ill neighbors, family members, they don't need to die. And when you have 8 weapons on your utility belt, maybe that's one of the things you reach for. So, it's a hard story, and I thank you for listening to it. Anybody can always get in touch with me and ask for more details if they want. I'm a pretty open book about things. I hope that I can use this opportunity, this experience I had to tell people that I was lucky that I had a family that loved me regardless. I was lucky because they could travel. They could take time off work and come see me in Ahoskie, North Carolina, 2.5 hours from Raleigh. A lot of families don't get it.
So I appreciate you sharing that very personal experience with us.
Yeah. You're welcome.
I have to ask, have you shared that story with any close friends and gotten their reaction or their feedback?
I'm embarrassed to live in my neighborhood, Sarah. I've lost friends in the neighborhood here. There are neighbors that don't treat me as well as they used to.
Well, even beyond your neighborhood. People who, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is have you shared this experience with anyone who wouldn't have had that same safety level? Somebody who, hearing the story, you know, hearing you say you thrusted your hands out of a window, might say, you know, why would you even think of doing that? And,
right.
You know.
Yeah, I wanted him to see that I didn't have a gun and just tried to bait him into it. I mean, I was not rational. I know that I was right about my rights. I was. My approach was horrible. So, I mean, I think I have a pretty firm grasp about what was right and what was wrong. I'm certain, you know, I'm not totally right about it, but, and I've talked to my therapist about it. Actually, my therapist apologized for changing my medication at that bad time. And, you know, I was thinking about switching therapists because of that. This incident, but it was really great that my therapist was just humbly said, yeah, great. I was wrong. And it was very courageous of a professional to do that. I mean, I still suffer with depression and I take medication to take care of it. And I talk to folks. Obviously, I talk to my wife. It's strained relationships with my parents, with my daughter. Unfortunately, my son was involved. He never saw anything violent or anything like that, but no dad wants their son to see that. So, yeah, I've talked to folks. I've talked to police a little bit. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to applaud those police. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. They have a program called CTI officers that are supposed to be involved in mental health instances. But sometimes people with mental health issues don't give the police the opportunity to do the work that they need to do. I know we're coming close to the end. I really want to reiterate that I feel a great deal of compassion for police because I believe the charge that they have been given is impossible to gently introduce violence into a person's life. Those words don't mix. And eventually one of those is going to win. And I'd prefer the gentleness win.
Well, I just have one last question for you and a bit more lighthearted here. This is my ending question that I like to ask. So if you had a magic wand and you didn't have to worry about the wording of a bill or how you're going to get votes across, but you could wave your magic wand and change one law or one policy, what would it be?
It would to be to change the premise of police action, maybe even change the name of what they're called. I would prefer the police primary charge was information, administration, publicly assisting people to live their life better. As a libertarian, obviously, I'd love to reduce the number of police on the force. And I tell you, if we change those 100 policemen from policemen into bus drivers getting kids in the poverty areas, poverty-stricken areas, getting them to the, you know, the parks more often, you know, providing father figures that are wonderful and mother figures, just, you know, on those bus trips back and forth, we create hope for the hopeless. Where there is no hope, men die. And that's why Mr. Obama's statement, hope and change, was so appealing to so many people, and we didn't see it because we refused to innovate. We relied on the axioms of educate and train and obey. No. We have to... Peterson, I believe, wrote a book. He says you have to barbecue the sacred cows. Sometimes what situation, the culture we built, harms people. And that's what we're doing. We may be happy that the criminals are tucked away neatly, but we're also destroying the future of their children's lives. And there has to be something. And that's why, you know, those 100 policemen turn them into bus drivers that are very well trained and charged with taking kids to the parks, because maybe we don't have so many gang members. Sometimes when you make those fundamental barbecues of the sacred cattle, what happens is you get unexpectedly glorious results.
People get fed.
Yeah, people get fed. And those police start to learn where those children are struggling and communicate and repair. And instead of an enforcement, you know, it's care. I don't know what to say more than that.
Well, thank you for taking some time out to talk to us.
Oh, it's my distinct pleasure. Thank you so much.
One more time, this is Olin Watson, who is a community organizer, activist, and former libertarian candidate in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Former Marine, we always have to say that.
Yes, and former Marine.
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm not allowed to say former anymore, actually. I have to say just Marine. I'm a Marine.
Was there anything else you wanted to make sure to cover, anywhere our listeners can get more information?
Yeah, I think we did not cover in the slightest bit the idea of what district attorneys can do to affect this picture. It is a whole different podcast for you, Sarah Wagner. And I'd love to invite you to invite me back sometime, and we can talk about that. But for your listeners, I really would recommend that they look into a Mr. Krasner, a civil rights lawyer turned district attorney in Philadelphia. What he's doing there is amazing. And it's certainly, I'm working on political action now to get our community to bring those ideas to our district attorney and demand some of those same things. Demands don't always work, but at least we can introduce the ideas to the context, and maybe somebody will move it forward.
Well, you can't do anything except at least try.
That's right. That's what we're here, is to create ideas and be a new light for a new generation of folks.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
This has been Speaking of Liberty, brought to you by the Libertarian Party of North Carolina. Find out more at lpnc.org.